Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to The Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona. Now I'd like to thank you for tuning in this evening, and you can thank yourself for the information you're going to get here that you don't get on other networks. Most of them run and hide from this topic of Israeli and Zionist and U.S. affairs, but it's documentable, so we're going to tell you. Now, this evening, is the 11th of February, 2010, Thursday the 11th, 2010, and you're going to want to take notes as usual, but first, the cursory information. If you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, or HOTT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com, that's hourofthetime.com. The studio number in Canada, 613-733-4324. And in Arizona, 928-333-2942. Now, if anybody would like to offer and share research, comment, ideas for future broadcasts, hints, etc., hate mail, what have you, you can email me directly at hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget that the Hour of the Time is listener-supported. And through your support, with donations for either outright or, better yet, for research materials, go to the website, hourofthetime.com, and then go to the Hot Shop. And there you can see hundreds of items, survival-type items for emergencies. You can see individual MP3 broadcast, MP3 bundles in topical arrangement, as in on a specific subject, like this current series we're in. You can see DVD sets and individual DVDs, publications, etc. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I hope that you all realize that through your support is how we do this. A, by not having idiotic corporate sponsors, like so many of the networks, we're not forced to gag down or shove down your throat ignorant commercials every 4 or 5 minutes or less, even sometimes for another 4 or 5 minutes of products that usually don't work, or they're extremely overpriced and targeted for the PAY Patriot market. It allows us to have unadulterated programming and sponsors or commercials not telling us what to say and what we can't say. So we do it on our own, and that's what the entrepreneurial and freedom spirit is about. Maybe consider that and think about that little notion next time you hear rip off overpriced silver or gold coins or so-called solar generators at twice their value, listed as three times their value for sale on other networks. And we've got tons of offers like that. We could do that and be doing quite well with it, but we choose to make it on our own with your support. Hopefully you don't sit back and force us to make a change like that, where you get to hear 3 minutes of programming, 3 to 4 minutes of ads. It's up to you, ladies and gentlemen. Now, as usual, we'll go to our cursory musical break at the beginning. That's the time for you to make sure you have your notes ready, either from a previous broadcast or something new to write with. Tonight, be ready to continue on your notes. This is part two in our Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy series, part two, and it's the Thursday, the 11th of February, 2010. So be ready to take a studious notes and learn a lot right after this break. Ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shanley, in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time. Again, the website, hourofthetime.com. My personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Studio number 928-333-2942 in Arizona, and in Canada, 613-733-4324. Now, as we often do in these series, is a brief recap. Go back just a touch where we finished off in the last broadcast to kind of get you back into the flow of things. And you might call this a section in your notes I told you in the last broadcast. You might call this compensation for past crimes, if you will, as a heading, just to help you out there. But going back just for a slight recap. When political Zionism began in earnest in the late 19th century, there were only about 15,000 Jews in Palestine. In 1893, for example, the Arabs comprised roughly 95% of the population. And though under Ottoman control, they had been in continuous possession of this territory for 1,300 years. Even when Israel was founded, Jews were only about 35% of Palestine's population and owned 7% of the land. And ladies and gentlemen, if you were smart enough to listen last night to the previous broadcast and email me, you would have got that whole list of citations like the two we just went over. Now, the mainstream Zionist leadership was not interested in establishing a binational state or accepting a permanent partition of Palestine. You see, the Zionist leadership was sometimes willing to accept partition as a first step, but this was a tactical maneuver and not their real objective. As David Ben-Gurion put it in the late 1930s, quote, "After the formation of a large army in the wake of the establishment of the state, we shall abolish partition and expand to the whole of Palestine," end quote. To achieve this goal, the Zionists had to expel large numbers of Arabs from the territory that would eventually become Israel. There was simply no other way to accomplish their objective. Ben-Gurion saw the problem clearly, writing in 1941 that, quote, "It is impossible to imagine general evacuation of the Arab population without compulsion and brutal compulsion," end quote. Or, as Israeli historian Benny Morris put it, quote, "The idea of transfer is as old as modern Zionism and has accomplished its evolution and praxis during the past century," end quote. This opportunity came about, ladies and gentlemen, in 1947 to 1948, when Jewish forces drove up to 700,000 Palestinians into exile. Israeli officials have long claimed that the Arabs fled because their leaders told them to. But careful scholarship, and much of it by Israeli historians like Morris, have demolished this myth. In fact, most Arab leaders urged the Palestinian population to stay home, but fear of violent death at the hands of Zionist forces led them to flee. After the war, Israel barred the return of the Palestinian exiles. And as an aside, ladies and gentlemen, an excellent research series for you to look into and read, because it's all packaged up, would be the recently completed Zionist Violation series for a good history of an international perspective and look and documentation of year, month, and day of many of those actions over there in that region. Also the ADL series, all available at ourthetime.com, and then go to the Hot Shop and you can find numerous series there for your research. Now to continue on with our piece tonight, which is the Israeli lobby and U.S. foreign policy, part two. The fact, ladies and gentlemen, that the creation of Israel entailed a moral crime against the Palestinian people was well understood by Israel's leaders. As Ben-Gurion told Nahum Goldman, president of the World Jewish Congress, quote, "If I were an Arab leader, and I would never make terms with Israel. That is natural. We have taken their country. We come from Israel, but 2,000 years ago. And what is that to them?" There has been anti-Semitism, the Nazis, Hitler, Auschwitz, but was that their fault? They only see one thing. We have come here and stolen their country. Why should they accept that? End quote. Since then, Israeli leaders have repeatedly sought to deny the Palestinians' national ambitions. Prime Minister Golda Meir famously remarked that, quote, "There was no such thing as a Palestinian," end quote, and even Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, who signed the 1993 Oslo Accords, nonetheless opposed creating a full-fledged Palestinian state. Pressure from extremist violence and the growing Palestinian population has forced subsequent Israeli leaders to disengage from some of the occupied territories and to explore territorial compromise. But no Israeli government has been willing to offer the Palestinians a viable state of their own. Even Prime Minister Barak's purportedly generous offer at Camp David in July 2000 would only have given the Palestinians a disarmed and dismembered set of, as it's called, Bantustans under de facto Israeli control. Europe's crimes against the Jews provide a clear moral justification for Israel's right to exist. But Israel's survival is not in doubt. Even if some Islamic extremists make outrageous and unrealistic references to, quote, wiping it off the map, end quote, and the tragic history of the Jewish people does not obligate the United States to help Israel no matter what it does today. Now, ladies and gentlemen, for your notes, you might call the next heading, Virtuous Israelis versus Evil Arabs. And, ladies and gentlemen, you'll see why, because the most commonly portrayed or spread about final moral argument portrays Israel as a country that has sought peace at every turn and showed great restraint even when provoked. The Arabs, by contrast, are said to have acted with great wickedness. This narrative, which is endlessly repeated by Israeli leaders and American apologists such as Alan Dershowitz, is yet another myth. In terms of actual behavior, Israel's conduct is not morally distinguishable from the actions of its opponents. Israeli scholarship shows that the early Zionists were far from benevolent towards the Palestinian Arabs. The Arab inhabitants did resist the Zionist encroachment, which is hardly surprising given that the Zionists were trying to create their own state on Arab lands. The Zionists responded vigorously. And neither side owns the moral high ground during this period. This same scholarship also reveals that the creation of Israel in 1947 to 48 involved explicit acts of ethnic cleansing, including executions, massacres, and rapes by Jews. Furthermore, Israel's subsequent conduct towards its Arab adversaries and its Palestinian subjects has often been brutal, belying any claim to morally superior conduct. Between 1949 and 1956, for example, Israeli security forces killed between 2,700 and 5,000 Arab infiltrators, the overwhelming majority of them unarmed. The IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, conducted numerous cross-border raids against its neighbors in the early 1950s, and though these actions were portrayed as defensive responses, they were actually part of a broader effort to expand Israel's borders. Israel's expansionist ambitions also led it to join Britain and France in attacking Egypt in 1956. And Israel withdrew from the lands it had conquered only in the face of intense U.S. pressure. The IDF also murdered hundreds of Egyptian prisoners of war in both the 1956 and 1967 wars. In 1967, it expelled between 100,000 and 260,000 Palestinians from the newly conquered West Bank, and drove 80,000 Syrians from the Golan Heights. It was also complicit in the massacre of 700 innocent Palestinians at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps following its invasion of Lebanon in 1982. and an Israeli investigatory commission found then Defense Minister Sharon, quote, personally responsible, end quote, for these atrocities. Israeli personnel have tortured numerous Palestinian prisoners, systematically humiliated and inconvenienced Palestinian civilians, and used force indiscriminately against them on numerous occasions. During the first Intifada, 87 to 1991, for example, the IDF distributed truncheons to its troops and encouraged them to break the bones of Palestinian protesters. The Swedish organization, Save the Children, estimated that, quote, 23,600 to 29,900 children required medical treatment for their beating injuries in the first 2 years of the Intifada, end quote, with nearly one-third sustaining broken bones. Nearly one-third of the beaten children were aged 10 and under. Israel's response to the second Intifada, 2000 to 2005, has been even more violent, leading Haaretz to declare that, quote, the IDF is turning into a killing machine whose efficiency is awe-inspiring yet shocking, end quote. The IDF fired 1 million bullets in the first days of the uprising, which is far from a measured response. Since then, Israel has killed 3.4 Palestinians for every Israeli lost, the majority of whom have been innocent bystanders. The ratio of Palestinian to Israeli children killed is even higher, 5.7 to 1. Israeli forces have also killed several foreign peace activists, including a 23-year-old American woman crushed by an Israeli bulldozer in March 2003. These facts about Israel's conduct have been amply documented by numerous human rights organizations. Thank you. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time. Again, our website, hourofthetime.com, and my personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you're taking numerous notes, and I hope many of you who were wise enough to heed last night's offer did so. Now, to go on to the documentation, ladies and gentlemen, just some more. Four former officials of Shin Bet, the Israeli domestic security organization, condemned Israel's conduct during the Second Intifada in November 2003. One of them declared, quote, "We are behaving disgracefully," end quote, and another termed Israel's conduct patently immoral. But isn't Israel entitled to do whatever it takes to protect its citizens? Doesn't the unique evil of terrorism justify continued U.S. support, even if Israel often responds harshly? In fact, ladies and gentlemen, this argument is not a compelling moral justification either. Palestinians have used terrorism against their Israeli occupiers, and their willingness to attack innocent civilians is wrong. This behavior is not surprising, however, because the Palestinians believe they have no other way to force Israeli concessions. As former Prime Minister Barak once admitted, he had been born a Palestinian. Had he been born a Palestinian, he, quote, would have joined a terrorist organization, end quote. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, you should not forget that the Zionists used terrorism when they were in a similarly weak position in trying to obtain their own state. Now, this is one that isn't mentioned very often. Between 1944 and 1947, several Zionist organizations used terrorist bombings to drive the British from Palestine and took the lives of many innocent civilians along the way. Israeli terrorists also murdered UN mediator Count Folke Bernadotte in 1948, and you can hear more on that, ladies and gentlemen, in the series Zionist Violations. Why did they murder him? Because they opposed his proposal to internationalize Jerusalem. Nor were the perpetrators of these acts isolated extremists. The leaders of the murder plot were eventually granted amnesty by the Israeli government, and one of them was elected to the Knesset. Another terrorist leader who approved the murder but was not tried was future Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. Indeed, Shamir openly argued that, quote, "Neither Jewish ethics nor Jewish tradition can disqualify terrorism as a means of combat," end quote. Rather, terrorism had, quote, "a great part to play in our war against the occupier Britain," end quote. If the Palestinians' use of terrorism is morally reprehensible today, so was Israel's reliance upon it in the past. And thus, one cannot justify U.S. support for Israel on the grounds that its past conduct was morally superior. Israel may not have acted worse than many other countries, but it clearly has not acted any better. And if neither strategic nor moral arguments can account for America's support for Israel, how are we to explain it? Ladies and gentlemen, the explanation lies in the unmatched power of the Israel lobby. Were it not for the lobby's ability to manipulate the American political system, the relationship between Israel and the United States would be far less intimate than it is today. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're on to a new heading for your notes. Now, the lobby. What is it? The lobby, if you will, is used as a convenient shorthand term for the loose coalition of individuals and organizations who actively work to shape U.S. foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. The use of this term, ladies and gentlemen, is not meant to suggest that the lobby is a unified movement with the central leadership, or that individuals within it do not disagree on certain issues. The core of the lobby is comprised of American Jews who make a significant effort in their daily lives to bend U.S. foreign policy so that it advances Israel's interest. Their activities go beyond merely voting for candidates who are pro-Israel, to include letter writing, financial contributions, and supporting pro-Israel organizations. But not all Jewish Americans are part of the lobby, because Israel is not a salient issue for many of them. For example, in a 2004 survey, roughly 36% of Jewish Americans said they were either not very or not at all emotionally attached to Israel. Jewish Americans also differ on specific Israeli policies. Many of the key organizations in the lobby, like AIPAC, which we defined in the last broadcast, and the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, that is CPMJO, Charlie, Papa, Mike, Juliet, Oscar, Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, are run by hardliners who generally support the expansionist policies of Israel's Likud party, including its hostility to the Oslo peace process. ladies and gentlemen, again, I hope you're taking careful notes. The bulk of U.S. Jewry, on the other hand, is more favorably disposed to make concessions to the Palestinians, and a few groups, such as Jewish Voice for Peace, strongly advocate such steps. Despite these differences, however, moderates and hardliners both support steadfast U.S. support for Israel. Not surprisingly, American Jewish leaders often consult with Israeli officials so that the former can maximize their influence in the United States. As one activist with a major Jewish organization wrote, quote, "It is routine for us to say, this is our policy on a certain issue, but we must check what the Israelis think. We, as a community, do it all the time." End quote. There is also a strong norm against criticizing Israeli policy, and Jewish American leaders rarely support putting pressure on Israel. Thus, Edgar Bronfman, Sr., the president of the World Jewish Congress, was accused of perfidy when he wrote a letter to President Bush in mid-2003, urging Bush to pressure Israel to curb construction of its controversial security fence. Critics declared that, quote, "It would be obscene at any time for the president of the World Jewish Congress to lobby the president of the United States to resist policies being promoted by the government of Israel." End quote. Similarly, when Israel Policy Forum, and that's another entity, when Israel Policy Forum President Seymour Reich advised Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to pressure Israel to reopen a critical border crossing in the Gaza Strip in November of 2005, critics denounced his action as irresponsible behavior and declared that, quote, "There is absolutely no room in the Jewish mainstream for actively canvassing against the security-related policies of Israel." End quote. Recoiling from these attacks, Reich proclaimed that, quote, "The word pressure is not in my vocabulary when it comes to Israel." End quote. Jewish Americans have formed an impressive array of organizations to influence American foreign policy, of which AIPAC is the most powerful and well known. In 1997, Fortune magazine asked members of Congress and their staffs to list the most powerful lobbies in Washington. AIPAC was ranked second behind the American Association of Retired People, AARP, but ahead of heavyweight lobbies like the AFL-CIO and the National Rifle Association. And in a study of March 2005 in the National Journal, a similar conclusion was reached, placing AIPAC in second place, tied with AARP, in the Washington's so-called muscle rankings. The lobby also includes prominent Christian evangelicals like Gary Bauer, Jerry Falwell, Ralph Reed, and Pat Robertson, as well as Dick Armey and Tom DeLay, former majority leaders in the House of Representatives. They believe Israel's rebirth is part of biblical prophecy, support its expansionist agenda, and think pressuring Israel is contrary to God's will. In addition, the lobby's membership includes neoconservative Gentiles such as John Bolton, the late Wall Street Journal editor Robert Bartley, former Secretary of Education William Bennett, former UN Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick, and columnist George Will. Ladies and gentlemen, the United States has a divided government that offers many ways to influence the policy process. As a result, interest groups can shape policy in many different ways, by lobbying elected representatives and members of the executive branch, making campaign contributions, voting in elections, molding public opinion, etc. Furthermore, special interest groups enjoy disproportionate power when they are committed to a particular issue and the bulk of the population is indifferent. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to recap that sentence right there again. Furthermore, special interest groups enjoy disproportionate power when they are committed to a particular issue and the bulk of the population is indifferent. Ladies and gentlemen, that ties in heavily to what you're seeing go on in another movement right now in this country, the so-called Tea Party and the Palin card and Ron Paul's three opponents, all from the Tea Party membership. A fifth column has arose, ladies and gentlemen, to split up what would have been a very large movement of mostly, although albeit ill-educated, but mostly good-hearted and intended Americans. Ties in excellently here with this example. Especially the last part of the sentence, the bulk of the population is indifferent. People will continue to run to the book signing parties and wave flags, all the while not even knowing what the Constitution says or even owning a copy. The split has begun, ladies and gentlemen, and you're already seeing political action committees buy up other political action committees and other organizations. Now, our country deserves better, for instance, is the umbrella mothership of about 11 operations, including the Tea Party Express. So keep this all in mind as you see all of the Palin book signing bullshit going on, her driving wedges in the Tea Party membership. Tea Party membership driving wedges in Ron Paul campaigns, and all of the fifth column activities here, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to be on the news a lot. Policymakers, ladies and gentlemen, will tend to accommodate those who care about the issue in question, even if their numbers are small, confident that the rest of the population will not penalize them. Ladies and gentlemen, that ties in quite well with Palin's throwing her support in this previous week of more horrendous anti-American news behind McCain, Manchurian candidate for Senate. But to continue on, I digressed, I'm sorry. The Israeli lobby's power flows from its unmatched ability to play this game of interest group politics. In its basic operations, it is no different from interest groups like the farm lobby, steel and textile workers, and other ethnic lobbies. What sets the Israel lobby apart is its extraordinary effectiveness. But there is nothing improper about American Jews and their Christian allies attempting to sway U.S. policy towards Israel. The lobby's activities are not the sort of conspiracy depicted in tracts like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. For the most part, the individuals and groups that comprise the lobby I guess both are fitting, are doing what other special interest groups do, just much better. Moreover, pro-Arab interest groups are weak to non-existence, which makes the lobby's task even easier. You see, ladies and gentlemen, the lobby pursues two broad strategies to promote U.S. support for Israel. First, it wields significant influence in Washington, pressuring both Congress and the executive branch to support Israel down the line. Whatever an individual lawmaker or policymaker's own views, the lobby tries to make supporting Israel the smart political choice. Secondly, the lobby strives to ensure that public discourse about Israel portrays it in a positive light by repeating myths about Israel and its founding and by publicizing Israel's side in the policy debates of the day. The goal, ladies and gentlemen, is to prevent critical commentary about Israel from getting a fair hearing in the political arena. Controlling the debate is essential to guaranteeing U.S. support. You see, because a candid discussion of U.S.-Israeli relations might lead Americans to favor a different policy. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona. And it is crazy. That's the only word that can be used for it. The amount, I shouldn't say the amount, but the very pointed emails we get with this type of broadcasting. But like I always figured, if you can't handle it, go tune in somewhere else. Now, how does this lobby do all this, ladies and gentlemen? And a key pillar, and it really can't be called anything else, of the lobby's effectiveness is its influence in the U.S. Congress, where Israel is virtually immune from criticism. This is in itself a remarkable situation because Congress almost never shies away from contentious issues, whether it's abortion, affirmative action, health care, welfare. There is certain to be some sort of lively, if not idiotic, debate on Capitol Hill. Where Israel is concerned, however, potential critics fall silent, and there is hardly any debate at all. One reason for the lobbyist's success with Congress is that some key members are Christian Zionists, like Dick Armey, who said in September 2002 that, quote, "My number one priority in foreign policy is to protect Israel," end quote. One would think that the number one priority for any congressman would be to protect America. But that is not what Army said. There are also Jewish senators and congressmen who work to make U.S. foreign policy support Israel's interest. Pro-Israel congressional staffers are another source of the lobby's power. As Morris Amate, a former head of AIPAC, once admitted, quote, "There are a lot of guys at the working level up here on Capitol Hill who happen to be Jewish, who are willing to look at certain issues in terms of their Jewishness. These are all guys who are in a position to make the decision in these areas for those senators. You can get an awful lot done just at the staff level." Sorry about that brief pause there, ladies and gentlemen. I just saw the phone light up, so I was scrambling to hit mute before we had phone ringing and talking on the air. Now, to continue on, though, with this, I would like to recap a couple things there because, see, you'll see this oft denied, but guess what? This is also sourced, and if you heeded my offer in the first broadcast of this series, you'd have all those sources. Let's go back again and think about what Morris Amate said. He was the former head of AIPAC, and he said, quote, "There are a lot of guys at the working level up here on Capitol Hill who happen to be Jewish, who are willing to look at certain issues in terms of their Jewishness. These are all guys who are in a position to make the decision in these areas for those senators. You can get an awful lot done just at the staff level." End quote. It is AIPAC itself, however, that forms the core of the lobby's influence in Congress. AIPAC's success is due to its ability to reward legislators and congressional candidates who support its agenda, and to punish those who challenge it. Money is critical to U.S. elections. As the recent scandal over lobbyist Jack Abramoff's various shady dealings reminds us, and AIPAC makes sure that its friends get strong financial support from the myriad pro-Israel political action committees. Those seen as hostile to Israel, on the other hand, can be sure that AIPAC will direct campaign contributions to their political opponents. AIPAC also organizes letter-writing campaigns and encourages newspaper editors to endorse pro-Israel candidates. There is, ladies and gentlemen, no doubt about the potency of these tactics. To take but one example, in 1984, AIPAC helped defeat Senator Charles Percy from Illinois, who, according to one prominent lobby figure, had, quote, displayed insensitivity and even hostility to our concerns, end quote. Thomas Dine, the head of AIPAC at the time, explained what happened. Quote, all the Jews in America, from coast to coast, gathered to oust Percy. And the American politicians, those who hold public positions now, and those who aspire, got the message. End quote. AIPAC prizes its reputation as a formidable adversary, of course, because it discourages anyone from questioning its agenda. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's where we'll end this evening. In this Thursday, the 11th of February, 2010, broadcast. And it's part two in our series on the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, we are listeners supported. Because if we weren't, and we had the average advertiser or corporate sponsor out there, we wouldn't be doing broadcasts like this, I guarantee you. Our website, hourofthetime.com. My personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. And I hope everyone has a safe and a studious evening.